Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and today I am back with another solved murder case for you guys. I only have a small brief case update for everyone on the Eric Richens case. His wife, Corey Richens, who is accused of murdering her husband with a fentanyl-laced Moscow mule, has been denied bail by Judge Richard Mrazek. According to Court TV, Corey has been behind bars for more than 2 years as she awaits her trial that is set to begin in late February 2026. Now, her attorney has been trying to fight to get her released on bond after telling the judge that a key prosecution witness has recanted his testimony. However, Judge Mrazek has decided that while this key prosecution witness recanted his testimony, there is still a substantial amount of evidence that should keep Corey behind bars for the time being. So Corey remains behind bars, and again, her trial is set to begin in late February of 2026, and that trial is expected to last 5 weeks. If you guys haven't listened to that episode, make sure you check it out. I will also be keeping an eye on that trial as it happens so I can give you guys all of the updates and the details when it all comes out. I also have some Patreon shoutouts to give today. This week, I had Rose and Angeline join the Patreon family. I appreciate both of your support more than a detective appreciates a surprise confession. Okay, that was me trying to be funny. I was trying to be witty, and I was trying to think of something different to say than my typical comments about appreciating the love and support. I thought it was funny. I hope you guys did too. I thought that was the perfect analogy for how much I do truly appreciate you guys joining the family. If you guys want to be like Rose and Angeline, you can join the family for just $2 a month, and you will get every single episode. That's old episodes and new episodes without those annoying, pesky ads. Join by visiting www.patreon.com/crimewithholly or check the link in the description of this episode. Okay, so today's case is going to be a crazy one. It's one of those ones where you think you know, but do you truly have an idea? I don't know. And it is one of those cases that was solved decades later, thanks to the work of cold case detectives. When you get all of the details, your jaw is going to drop. So please make sure that you leave comments on Spotify about your thoughts and opinions if you listen over there, or you can comment on social media. I am dying to know what you guys are going to think about this as this one all unfolds. So without further ado, let's get into the details of today's case. Today's episode is on the murder of Sherry Rasmussen Rutten. Sherry Sherry Ray Rasmussen was born on February 7th, 1957 in Walla Walla, Washington, to her parents Nels and Loretta Rasmussen. Sherry was the middle child and had two sisters named Connie and Teresa. Though she was born in Washington, Sherry actually grew up in Tucson, Arizona, where her father was a dentist with his own family practice, and Loretta worked as the office manager. Sherry grew up in a very tight-knit family, and of course they had those sibling fights here and there, but for the most part, Sherry and her sisters were very close. Sherry was referred to as the glue that held her family together. And both of her sisters described her in this way. Whenever times got tough or people were down in the family, Sherry would be the comic relief that everyone needed, and with her unique little giggle, she would have people smiling when they needed it most. The biggest thing that everyone said about Sherry was that family was everything to her, and she would do anything for those that she loved. Sherry was described as being very kind and caring, and from a young age, it was very clear that Sherry was wise beyond her years, and she was incredibly smart. Sherry also was very driven, and she was able to graduate high school at the age of 16, and she did not stop there. Immediately after graduating at 16 years old, she enrolled herself in nursing school. And that was very fitting for Sherry because she always wanted to take care of people. Now, let me just add what an amazing accomplishment all of this is. To graduate high school early and immediately jump into a nursing program at just 16 years old is absolutely incredible. She clearly was wise beyond her years, like I mentioned, and to know what she wanted to do at such a young age and then pursue it is just very admirable. But Sherry was just getting started. At the age of 21, with her nursing career already taking off, Sherry made the brave decision to leave behind the desert life in Tucson, Arizona, and to trade it in for the bright lights of Los Angeles, California. She had dreams of attending UCLA for her master's in nursing, and she was finally admitted into that program in June of 1978. While Sherry was working as a nurse and attending classes for her master's degree, she really put her dating and social life on the back burner. Her life literally revolved around school. And on the rare occasion she took a break to socialize, it was usually with classmates or fellow nurses and residents from the hospital. In March of 1980, Sherry graduated with her master's degree at the age of 23. And again, that is amazing. I am truly so blown away about how goal-oriented and driven Sherry was. And her father, who was a hardworking dentist, encouraged Sherry to continue her schooling and become a doctor. But she was adamant that she wanted to stick with nursing because she really enjoyed the hands-on, caring aspect that came with the nursing career field. Not long after graduating from her master's program, Sherry settled into a cute little split-level condo located in Van Nuys, which is a neighborhood in the central San Fernando Valley region of Los Angeles. She picked this place because it seemed like the neighborhood was safe and the overall security of the condo was promising. Life was going well for Sherry. She was rising in the nursing world and was so excited that she landed a new job as the director of critical care nursing at Glendale Adventist Medical Center. According to the Lazarus Files, that critical care division included the emergency department, surgical intensive care unit, medical intensive care unit, coronary care unit, and definitive observation unit for patients who required long-term care. She started her job on February 27th, 1984. Right off the bat, she thrived, which should come as no surprise. That was just Sherry. She surpassed all expectations that her hiring officials had for her, and she carried herself in such a positive and professional manner. People loved working for her. In the spring of 1984, while living in LA, Sherry met a young computer engineer named John Rutten at a mutual friend's party. John had attended UCLA in San Diego and was this athletic, tall, dark, and handsome young man. When he laid eyes on Sherry, he was taken aback by her and was immediately drawn into her infectious personality and big, beautiful smile. Almost immediately after meeting, the two began dating, and from that moment on, Sherry always had a smile on her face. The two made each other incredibly happy, and you can almost feel their love and happiness through all of their pictures. A few months into dating, Sherry introduced John to her family, and they all fell in love with him as well. They could tell that Sherry was head over heels for John, and ultimately, they just wanted her to be happy. A year after they began dating, Sherry and John got engaged to be married, and he moved into Sherry's condo with her. On November 23rd, 1985, Sherry and John got married in an intimate wedding ceremony surrounded by their closest friends and family. Sherry looked radiant on her wedding day, and together the couple seemed to glow with happiness and love. Sherry and John spent Christmas with her family, where they both loved on their new baby niece. Jokes were made that a baby Rutten will be next to join the family. They were all smiles and laughs as they gathered around the family Christmas tree. Sherry beaming with so much happiness while celebrating her favorite holiday, surrounded by all that loved her. Little did they know, their happily ever after would be stripped away just 2 short months later.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
On February 24th, 1986, just 3 months after their wedding, Sherry and John started off their morning like any other Monday morning. Sherry was dreading going into work because she was set to give a motivational pep talk style class. And they did these types of classes frequently on Monday mornings. Sherry, who rarely complained about work, hated these classes. Though she was great at public speaking and didn't fear talking in front of people, she felt like these motivational presentations were ineffective and a waste of her time. While John was bustling about getting ready for work, Sherry laid in bed contemplating calling in sick to avoid the class and because she had tweaked her back the day before during a workout at the gym. By the time that John left their condo at 7:20 a.m., Sherry was still cuddled up under the covers on the fence about whether she was going to go into work or not. On his way into work, John stopped off at the dry cleaners to drop off some laundry, and then he made it to his desk sometime just before 8 a.m. Mid-morning, John decided to call home to see if Sherry was still there and to check in on her and see how she was feeling. But when she didn't answer, he just assumed that she decided to go into work after all. He called her work and spoke with Sherry's secretary, and she said that she hadn't seen Sherry yet that morning. But that honestly wasn't unusual. Sherry didn't always stop off at the office on those Monday mornings when she had to give those classes. She would just go straight to the class and sometimes not even go into the office at all during those days. Throughout the rest of his workday, John tried to call Sherry at home. He called 3 or 4 times, and each time the phone would just ring and ring and ring. Now, he thought that was odd that the answering machine wasn't turned on, but he knew that his wife was sometimes forgetful and would leave the house before turning it on. And for those that didn't know, back in those days, answering machines weren't automatic. People had to physically switch them on when they weren't going to be home so that someone could leave a voice message. But again, John just assumed that Sherry was in a rush to get out the door. She forgot to turn it on. Most mornings, Sherry left the house before he did, and he knew that she had been laying in bed when he left. Maybe she finally drug herself out of bed and rushed out the door so she wouldn't be late. And while John felt that this was a little unusual, he wasn't concerned. This was during a time that cell phones weren't in everyone's hands at all times of the day. It wasn't uncommon not to hear from your loved ones all day long or to not be able to get in touch with them. After leaving the office for the evening, John ran a few errands before heading home. He stopped back off at the dry cleaners to pick up his freshly laundered clothes, and he went to the UPS store before making that drive home. When he pulled into their driveway, he was surprised to see that their garage door was open and Sherry's BMW was gone. This still wasn't that alarming for him. He just figured that Sherry forgot to shut the garage when she left. He parked inside the garage, grabbed his dry cleaning, and walked up the garage stairs to the door that led into their living room. To his surprise, the door was slightly ajar, and this is when alarm bells started to ring in his head. As he eased into the living room, he found his wife of only 3 months on the floor, lying on her back, still in her red bathrobe, clearly deceased. He immediately called 911, and when officers arrived, they called in the homicide unit because it was very clear that Sherry had been brutally murdered. Upon entering the condo, it was very clear to homicide detectives that Sherry fought for her life. The living room was a mess. Furniture was tossed about, stereo speakers were knocked over, a drawer from a side table was pulled out, a broken vase was smashed all over the ground, and investigators believe that this vase was actually used to strike Sherry in the head and face because the shards found on the ground were covered in blood. They found a VCR and CD player stacked neatly beside the stairs that led to the kitchen area. Almost as if these two items were going to be taken but were accidentally left behind. These two items stacked in front of the stairs would become a major focal point in the investigation. Because of those items, they assumed that Sherry was a victim of a burglary gone wrong. Also, to go along with this theory, Sherry's purse was missing, as well as her newer BMW car. The investigators pieced together that Sherry's murder had taken place sometime earlier that morning because she was still in her bathrobe. They believe that Sherry had been sitting at the kitchen table doing work when the intruder or intruders walked in through the front door. There had been no sign of forced entry, and so it seems that the front door had been left unlocked. At some point, Sherry had been tied up because she had very clear ligature markings on her wrists. And they found cords that had been cut from different electronic devices in the home, and they assumed that those had been used to bind Sherry. It seems that during the attack, Sherry was able to get herself free from her restraints and ran for the door. Her attacker chased after her and picked up the vase from a table in the home and struck Sherry in the head with it. Sherry was able to reach the front door where she tried to claw her way out, breaking off her fingernails in the process, which were later found near the door. Before Sherry was able to escape, she was shot once. The intruder then grabbed a blanket and wrapped it around the gun and pressed the gun to Sherry's chest, shooting her two more times, using the blanket to muffle the sound. Whoever did this to Sherry wanted to make sure that she suffered and that there was no chance that she would survive this horrific attack. Not only had Sherry been shot three times, but she had also suffered a severe beating as she fought for her life. On Sherry's inner left forearm, they also found a bite mark, which of course was swabbed for saliva. Now, obviously, investigators knew that they needed to question John. And while he remained on scene and seemed to be sobbing, some investigators couldn't help but notice that his reaction and the tears that he shed didn't quite match what you would expect from someone who had just found their wife, their newlywed wife, brutally murdered. But I will say that obviously that doesn't mean anything, and everyone grieves differently. John was taken down to the station for questioning and told the authorities about his day. He said everything was normal when he left the house that morning. He dropped off his dry cleaning, went to work. After work, he stopped to pick up his dry cleaning and then went to the UPS store, then arrived home between 6 and 7 p.m. Authorities asked John to take a polygraph test, and he readily agreed. But the results came back as inconclusive. While he was there, Sherry's family arrived at the station. They had been notified almost immediately about Sherry, and so they drove up from Southern California. Though they couldn't speak to John directly, they were able to see him from a slight distance. And Sherry's sister Connie said that she really looked John up and down and gave him a full visual inspection to see if he had any visible markings on him. Though she didn't believe that John was capable of hurting her sister and she loved him like a brother, she knew that you truly never knew what was happening behind closed doors. And she knew that her sister would have fought for her life if someone was trying to harm her. But to her relief, John was completely unscathed. So while John's results for the polygraph test came back as inconclusive, he had a solid alibi. People at his work vouched that he was there all day and never left, and he also had time-stamped receipts from all of his stops. During his questioning, John was adamant that he did not harm his wife, and ultimately he was ruled out as being involved. And with him being ruled out, the investigators were leaning on the burglary gone wrong theory even more. Investigators spent days canvassing the neighborhood trying to find anyone who may have witnessed anything unusual. Not a single person saw anything, and even crazier, nobody heard anything. At the scene of the crime, they found zero fingerprints or any other evidence to help them figure out who did this. With not much to go on, they continue to push the narrative that this was a burglary gone wrong, and the theory only intensified when there was another burglary a week later in the same Van Nuys neighborhood. Everything about this crime seemed very similar to Sherry's murder. Two men were interrupted during a home invasion when a woman who lived there came home. One of the men flashed a gun at her before they took off on foot. A sketch of these men was created to share across local media in hopes that someone would recognize them. They were hopeful that if they could find them, then they might be able to link them to Sherry's murder. Unfortunately, they were never able to track these men down. Now, while the police thought this was a burglary gone wrong, Sherry's parents from day one thought that there was no way that that was what it was. Things just didn't add up for them. If someone was going to kill Sherry in order to burglarize the home, why would they only steal her purse and her car, which the car was also later recovered, just abandoned with the keys left inside? There was plenty of other valuables within the home, and yet they weren't taken. There was money, there was jewelry, and many other things. It almost felt like those items that were stacked in front of the stairs was almost placed there intentionally to make the scene look a certain way. As soon as Sherry's father, Nels, was able to speak to investigators on that first day, he told them about some weird and unsettling events that had happened in the weeks and months leading up to her murder. Nels told police that there was a nurse that Sherry had worked with that didn't receive a promotion, and this nurse had been extremely upset with Sherry about it. This other nurse had gotten into an argument with Sherry about not receiving this promotion, and not long after this situation, Sherry noticed that she had damage done to her car, and she had assumed that maybe this other nurse had intentionally damaged her car, but she could never prove it. So when Sherry was murdered, her father Nels was worried that maybe this woman had escalated things further. Then there was one of John Rutten's ex-girlfriends who randomly showed up at Sherry's office one day after Sherry and John got engaged. This woman was dressed very provocatively, and she tells Sherry that when the marriage falls apart, she will be ready to pick up the pieces. To which Sherry replied, "Don't worry, we won't be needing your services." There was one more encounter with this same ex-girlfriend. About a month before Sherry's murder, she was at home getting ready for work when she heard something happening downstairs. Now, at that time, Sherry was alone. John was gone. And when she went down the stairs, she found this woman, the same ex-girlfriend, standing in the middle of her living room. Now, I'm not exactly sure what she was doing there or if maybe this woman didn't think anyone was home, but I guess Sherry started yelling at her and told her to get out of the house and never come back. Then, just days before the murder, Sherry told her father, Nels, that she was being watched and followed by someone with piercing eyes. Unfortunately, Sherry never told her family the name of this ex-girlfriend and or if this person that was following her was the same person. However, I do feel like if Sherry realized this person with the piercing eyes was the same person as the ex-girlfriend, she likely would have said that to her father. According to Nels, he told the authorities about these incidents with the ex-girlfriend, but one of the original detectives on the case stated that he was never told about this, and none of the reports and documents reflected this information either. I feel like Nels and Sherry's family would know if they brought this information forward. So how did this huge detail slip through the cracks? Why didn't anyone think to follow up with this, and why wasn't it documented? Deputy District Attorney Paul Nunez said that Nels told him that he told the authorities for years about this ex-girlfriend of John's. And though there was no record of it, Paul Nunez believes that those conversations were had, and for whatever reason, they were never documented. On the night of the murder, when detectives sat down with John, they asked him if he could think of anyone that would want to harm Sherry. They blatantly asked John if she was having any issues with an ex-boyfriend or him with an ex-girlfriend, and he said no. They asked him if anyone had been hitting on her or if anyone had been following her home, and John replied that he didn't think that there was anything out of the ordinary. Now, according to John, he never brought up this specific woman during his first initial recorded interview because he never considered her a girlfriend. nor did he think that she was capable of harming Sherry. But as time passed and he really started to think about things, the more he started to wonder if that ex-fling was actually involved. And so not only was Nels telling the authorities about this woman, but John also mentioned her a few times to them as well. And of course, that was not really documented. I will say that the original detective, Detective Mayer, who was assigned this case back when it first happened, has declined to give any statements when asked about whether he was aware of this ex-girlfriend. The LAPD has also been asked to comment about this, and they declined to comment as well, which we will get into the why I think they've been tight-lipped about it in just a bit. So just pocket that little tidbit of information for later. Sherry's family took her passing extremely hard, and her father almost felt like he had failed her. He felt like as her parent, his job was to protect his children, and he was just devastated that he lost Sherry and that he wasn't there to save her. And that really ate at him. With no real leads that investigators were following and the running theory that this was a burglary gone wrong, the case went cold. In 1991, the lead detective, Detective Mayer, retired, and for years this case just sat. From my understanding, after Detective Mayer retired, nobody touched the case file and it sat on a shelf essentially collecting dust for an entire decade. As time passed, her family started to lose hope that it would ever be solved, and what a hopeless feeling that must have been. I always say that the unknown would eat me alive. To not know what happened to my missing loved one or my murdered loved one would be next to unbearable for me, so I can't imagine the pain they felt as each year passed. Sherry's absence was felt through many major family milestones. And as they gathered around during the holidays, Sherry's larger-than-life personality and loud, unique laugh was so deeply missed. And while they never thought that this case would be solved, in 2001, a brand new homicide cold case unit was launched at the LAPD. And this new unit was handed over 9,000 unsolved murders that spanned over two decades. And of course, Sherry's case was one of them. When Detective Cliff Shepard from the LAPD's new homicide cold case unit got his hands on Sherry's file, he went through the entire case file and pulled out key pieces of information. And he essentially created a whole new file to practically start from scratch with. As he was combing through all of these details of Sherry's case, he learned about the bite mark that had been on Sherry's arm. The file indicated that a swab had been taken of the bite mark, yet the information and that piece of evidence was nowhere to be found. At the time of Sherry's murder, DNA was just in the early phases. And while it was being used in murder cases, it was still a new technology and a new science. Thankfully, the investigators did take that saliva swab, but what they did with it after that was unknown. Where was it? According to Detective Shepard, he contacted the LAPD evidence room, and they also didn't have any evidence or documentation of ever having possession of this swab. It was like this swab never existed. But Detective Shepard was persistent and was adamant that they had to find that swab. And with the help of a criminalist for the LAPD and a lot of time spent searching, they finally located it. It had been shoved deep into a freezer at the LA County Medical Examiner's office. Once Detective Shepard had his hands on that swab, he sent it off for testing. But unfortunately, the LAPD was so backlogged that it would take 2 full years before the sample was even tested. When the results came in, they were able to get a full DNA profile, which is amazing. And to their surprise, their suspect was a woman. The DNA profile was entered into the law enforcement database CODIS, and at that time, there was no match, meaning that whoever killed Sherry had never been arrested and their DNA had never been taken and put into the system. Even though they had this full DNA profile, Detective Shepard was at a standstill. And sadly, he wasn't able to give full effort into solving Sherry's case because he had so many other unsolved cases sitting on his desk. He wasn't able to follow up with any interviews, which he states in a 2020 episode he fully regrets. Because had he done so, Detective Shepard believes that this case could have and would have been solved sooner. Sherry's case was once again placed on a shelf in 2005, where it would sit for another 4 years untouched by anyone. So let's pause here a bit and discuss the fact that the DNA that was found belonged to a woman. For nearly two decades, investigators were under the assumption that this was a robbery gone wrong and had used those composite sketches from the other burglary in an attempt to identify who murdered Sherry. But all of that kind of went out the window when they realized a woman was involved. When it came back that a woman had bit Sherry, they still assumed that there were multiple assailants in this case. They started to theorize that maybe one person had a gun while the other one did not. They thought that potentially the woman that was involved was in some sort of physical altercation with Sherry inside of the home, because they know that Sherry fought for her life. They believe that maybe at some point Sherry grabbed onto this unidentified woman, and that is when she bit Sherry in an attempt to get her to let go. Or perhaps Sherry was beating up the other person that was there, and this woman went to go help, and she bit Sherry then. Obviously, this was just speculation, but they know for a fact that Sherry was fierce in her fight for her life, and had the person not had a gun, Sherry likely would have kicked their butts. This part of the story is very frustrating for me because I just wish so badly that someone would have contacted Sherry's family and her husband John to ask them about a woman who may have wanted to harm Sherry. These were new investigators on the case, and had they asked those questions, they would have received a name. They all had been screaming the answer for years, yet nobody listened. If they had just made one single phone call to ask about a potential woman wanting to harm Sherry, John would have given them that name. They would have had their answer. But once again, I think they were so focused on this being a burglary gone wrong, opposed to a targeted attack. And in my opinion, the way in which Sherry was murdered doesn't really scream a burglary to me, but what do I know? It's just very, very frustrating. So in 2009, a detective named Jim Nuttall from the Van Nuys division took over Sherry's case. And he was just combing through the details when he noticed that 4 years prior, DNA indicated that a woman was who attacked and killed Sherry. When he started looking at the crime scene photos and really reviewed all that was missing from the house, he was not buying that burglary story at all. He started to theorize that the murder happened first, then whomever was involved attempted to stage the scene as a burglary that was interrupted. Jim Nuttall also felt like this attack was a personal one. Whoever did this to Sherry had beat her badly, then shot her 3 times, with 2 of those shots literally being pressed to her chest. This person wanted Sherry dead. They wanted to make sure that there was no way that she would survive. And that feels personal. Jim Nuttall and his team of people started conducting new interviews with those closest to Sherry, including her parents and, of course, her husband, John. Jim was very strategic with his interviewing process. he wanted to make sure that he excluded any female individuals from this interview process because he was creating a list of women that were within Sherry's orbit so that he could eliminate them one by one with DNA testing. He started with Sherry's two sisters and a friend of hers named Jane Goldberg. Jane says that one day officers arrived at her home and requested to swab her for DNA. And of course, she agreed. Sherry was one of her best friends. Jane and Sherry's two sisters were ruled out almost immediately. The fourth person on their list was that nursing colleague I mentioned earlier that was upset over not receiving the promotion. She and Sherry had a lot of tension and bad blood not too long before her murder, and it was important to rule her out. They also obtained a DNA sample from her, and she was ruled out. The fifth and final person on their female suspect list was a person that John Rutten said they needed to look into because she was once a romantic partner of his and she had caused some issues leading up to Sherry's murder. This woman is the same woman that Sherry's family spoke of and who John told police about over 20 years prior, but it was never recorded or looked into. And that woman's name is Stephanie Lazarus. During his interview with Detective Nuttall, John says that he told police 23 years prior about Stephanie Lazarus and her obsession with him. He details how he remembers that Stephanie went to go see Sherry and how upset she was that the two of them wouldn't be continuing their relationship. In that meeting with Detective Nuttall, he shared his frustration that none of his earlier comments about Stephanie seemed to have ever been recorded, and that police investigating never did their part to look into her either. Through his digging into the full case file, Detective Nuttall was able to find one piece of paper that at the very bottom of the page, it had been handwritten that John had mentioned Stephanie Lazarus. And next to her name was the letters P.O. When Detective Nuttall asked John about the meaning behind that P.O., he said that he had told investigators back in the day that she was a police officer. And for me, this is a light bulb moment. Did they write this tip off because there was no way that a police officer would commit such a crime? It seems likely. Now, 23 years later, Stephanie still worked for LAPD as a detective. And what is absolutely crazy about all of this is that while this cold case unit is working on Sherry's murder, Stephanie Lazarus's office was just down the hall on the same floor at police headquarters. Talk about wild. The detectives could have never imagined investigating someone who was literally feet away from them. Detective Nuttall knew that he had to keep this information close to the vest, and only those working directly on the case knew of the findings. Any time that they would speak about Stephanie, instead of referring to her by her name, she was referred to as suspect number 5. They couldn't risk tipping anyone off on this. So let me just take a second to talk about Stephanie Lazarus and just give you a bit of her background. Stephanie Lazarus attended UCLA, and that is how she met John Rutten when they both were students there. Stephanie was a D1 athlete and was incredibly smart, driven, and dedicated to all that she did, including chasing after John. From the moment that she met him, she was infatuated with John and had envisioned this big, romantic, long life together. John, on the other hand, did not hold those same feelings, and he claims that he never once looked at Stephanie in the same way. In the early 1980s, after graduating from UCLA, Stephanie joined the LAPD and was one of the very few women on the force, and she excelled at her job. Co-workers really liked her, she did well in specialized units, and she even competed in the California Police Olympics. One of Stephanie's close friends on the force was a woman named Anita. The two got along great at work, and Anita really admired Stephanie's athleticism as well as her tenacity. And while Stephanie was this force to be reckoned with when it came to her work, she really showed Anita her soft side when talking about her boyfriend, John. She told Anita all about John and how they met at UCLA, and she gave the impression that the two were going to get married. And while Anita was under the impression that Stephanie and John were serious, John, on the other hand, did not feel the same. And instead, he just looked at Stephanie as a fling or someone to hook up with. Despite John not showing too much interest back towards Stephanie, she kept pushing in hopes that finally John would change his mind. Stephanie threw a surprise birthday party for John's 25th birthday, and it was there that she overheard him talking about his new and serious relationship with Sherry. And this sent her spiraling, and it was documented in her diary that was over 600 pages of handwritten entries. She wrote about John and how devastated she was that he had a girlfriend, and when she learned that they were engaged, she wrote about that too. Even though Stephanie was having all of these feelings and emotions going on about John's new relationship and his happiness with this other woman, on the outside, she held herself together and continued to talk about her boyfriend, John. She was always upbeat and happy out in public and at work, but her diaries paint a very different story. One evening, Stephanie went to John's condo where he was living alone at that time, and this was before he moved in with Sherry, obviously, and it was then that he and Stephanie slept together one final time, and he was together with Sherry at this point. Stephanie was obviously upset about John moving on, and he claims that this last encounter was to give her some sort of closure. But in the months and weeks leading up to Sherry's murder, Stephanie continues to stew in her diary about John getting married. After Sherry's murder, Stephanie's career at the LAPD really began to take off. She was described as being a walking billboard for female recruitment. Stephanie was very involved and even made an appearance on the famous show Family Feud, where the LAPD went head-to-head against the LA Fire Department. With her outgoing personality and big smile, Stephanie really helped the LAPD shine, and they really loved having her as part of the team. During the 80s, the LAPD really wanted to hire more women, and having such an outstanding person like Stephanie on the team, that really helped with their recruiting techniques. Stephanie was promoted to detective, and in 1992, she was assigned to the personnel division where she was working as a background investigator. Her job was to interview and pass judgment on applicants who were applying to the LAPD. As time passed, Stephanie finally moved on from John and she fell in love with another police officer and the two got married. And then eventually they adopted a daughter. Come 2009, when she was being investigated for Sherry's murder, unbeknownst to her, Stephanie was working in the art theft division at LAPD. At that time, this was the only art theft division in the country. So while she was investigating criminals who stole art, she was being investigated for a far worse crime.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
In June 2009, LAPD cold case detectives were closer than ever to solving the 23-year-old murder of Sherry Rasmussen Rutten. For months, they had been quietly working on narrowing down the suspect list, and when they finally had a strong lead, they were shocked to find that it was one of their own. They only referred to her as suspect number 5 while they finally connected all of the pieces. Stephanie Lazarus was suspect number 5, and she worked down the hall from the cold case detectives. They didn't want to tip Stephanie off at all, so they made the decision not to contact her until they knew without a doubt that she was involved. The special investigation section began tracking and watching Stephanie, waiting for her to throw something away that they could swab for her DNA. Luck would have it that it didn't take long, and they followed her to a Costco where she purchased a drink and threw it away before leaving the store. Investigators were able to discreetly retrieve that cup for DNA testing without her even knowing. After sending the sample off for testing, investigators were finally able to confirm that the DNA belonged to Stephanie, an exact match to the bite mark found on Sherry's arm. And I can only imagine what that moment felt like for authorities. To realize that someone who worked just down the hall, someone who had sworn an oath to serve and protect, had not only committed murder, but had managed to hide behind her badge for 23 years. It had to be a shocking, surreal moment to get that positive confirmation. Instead of going and arresting her on the spot, they instead lured her into her own interrogation. Detectives approached Stephanie and told her that they had this suspect that was talking about some art heist in lockup, and they wanted to bring her down there to go talk to him. Instead, when she walked into the interrogation room, she was met with another detective. So Stephanie sits down with them and they tell her that they've been assigned a case that's a new case, and she seems willing to help them. Now, what she doesn't know is that she is being recorded. They start talking, she's talking back, and then all of a sudden they spring it on her. Do you know John Rutten? And she repeats the name, John Rutten, and she seems to be sitting there thinking, and then she goes, John Rutten? And the detective is like, oh, yeah, John Rutten. From that moment on, Stephanie seems to kind of flip a switch, and she almost seems defensive. She asks them, what's this all about? And they tell her that it's actually about his wife. And they start talking about Sherry and her murder. When looking at the video, you can tell that Stephanie was internally panicking. She looks absolutely terrified, but you can tell that she's trying really hard to play it cool. They asked her if she knew of the circumstances regarding Sherry's death. And Stephanie makes a show of it, like she's trying to think back that far about what had happened. She finally says that she thinks that it was a burglary or something, but she can't quite remember because it's been a long time. When asked about John, Stephanie kind of tried to distance herself from him. She admitted that the two had dated, but she didn't ever really consider him a boyfriend, she says. And she said that she didn't assume that he would consider her a girlfriend, which we know is a damn lie, because Stephanie gushed all about John to her coworker, Anita. detectives were able to get Stephanie to admit to going to the hospital and meeting with Sherry. When asked how the relationship was between herself and Sherry, she kind of played it off like things were fine, despite Stephanie truly feeling like she had lost John to Sherry. Detectives knew that she was full of crap, and they had evidence to prove it. Then they slap it on her that they think that they have DNA from the crime scene, and she goes into a full-blown panic, saying now she needs to talk to a lawyer. One thing that I really notice about this entire interview is Stephanie's eyes. She has very piercing eyes. Honestly, they kind of freak me out a little bit, not gonna lie, because they just make her have this evil look about her. You guys will see what I mean when I post pictures, but she really does have these large, eerie, piercing eyes. And if you remember earlier, Sherry mentioned to her father that she had felt like she was being watched and followed by someone with piercing eyes. It was mentioned, but I'm not sure if it was ever fully confirmed, but it was mentioned that Stephanie would dress up like a man to follow and watch Sherry. And I fully believe the person that Sherry described to her dad with piercing eyes was, in fact, Stephanie undercover. At the end of the interview, Stephanie was arrested for the murder of Sherry Rasmussen Rutten. And this arrest sent a shockwave through the community. To find out one of their longtime sworn officers did this was just a massive shock. Detectives went to the home of Sherry's family to give them the news they had all been waiting for. Sherry's killer had been arrested. And what a flood of emotions they all felt. They felt relief and joy that Sherry would finally get justice. But with that excitement comes the heartache all over again. At her arraignment, Stephanie pled not guilty, and her trial began in early 2012, 26 years after Sherry's murder. The prosecution argued that Stephanie murdered Sherry because she was jealous of the relationship that she had with John. Stephanie felt like John had been stolen from her, and she was angry enough to kill Sherry for it. The prosecution not only had the physical evidence from the bite mark, but they also had proof from Stephanie's diaries that she had been watching and stalking John over a significant amount of time. It was very clear that Stephanie was obsessed with John and even wrote about how stressed she was about the fact that he was getting married and how she just couldn't focus. Now, the defense tried their hardest to cast doubt on the DNA evidence from the bite mark and even said that Stephanie had been framed, which is just crazy to even try and say she was being framed for this, and the jury wasn't buying it either. After 3 weeks, the case was handed over to the jury and they returned with a verdict in less than 2 days. They found Stephanie Lazarus guilty of first-degree murder. In March of 2012, Stephanie's sentencing hearing took place, and she was sentenced to 25 to life for first-degree murder and 2 years for the use of a gun. And while justice had finally been served, the Rasmussens weren't done fighting. They were angry, and rightfully so. This should have never taken this long to be solved, and the Rasmussens questioned whether the LAPD had looked the other way because they didn't want this creating a dark cloud over the department. Did they cover this up? Did they ignore all the signs because they pointed to one of their beloved officers? And that is why I wonder, and why I mentioned earlier, that they are tight-lipped and they refuse to make comments. Sherry's family filed a civil lawsuit against the LAPD, but it was eventually dismissed because it exceeded the statute of limitations. The Rasmussens also filed a formal complaint against the LAPD, and their internal affairs department launched an investigation. But unfortunately, nothing came of it. But at least the Rasmussens could rest assured that Stephanie was going to be behind bars for a very long time. But in November of 2023, they got the shock of their life. Stephanie Lazarus went up for her first parole hearing, and this was way before anyone had anticipated that she would even be eligible for early release. Turns out that the state of California, in the years since Stephanie's conviction, passed a new law giving special consideration towards paroling what they call youthful offenders, which was for anyone under the age of 26 when they committed their crime. Stephanie was 25 years old when she murdered Sherry. Friends, family, and fellow prisoners wrote to the parole board in support of Stephanie's release. During her parole hearing, Stephanie took responsibility for Sherry's murder, and this was the first time that she admitted guilt. Prior to this, she claimed that she was innocent, but finally she admitted that she did it, and she admitted it for selfish reasons. She felt in her heart that if she admitted that she was guilty and took responsibility for Sherry's murder, that she would be granted parole, and she was right. At the conclusion of this hearing, she was granted parole, and everyone that knew Sherry was livid. How could this be? Stephanie Lazarus went under the radar for over 23 years, and yet only a little over a decade behind bars was all she was going to have to serve. It just did not make any kind of sense, and that was not justice for Sherry. However, thankfully, before her release could be granted and everything could be finalized, Governor Gavin Newsom stepped in and asked that this case go to the full parole board for reconsideration. In May 2024, at a follow-up appearance with the full parole board, Sherry's loved ones all stepped up to fight against Stephanie's release. Many, many of her friends, family, and John Rutten all spoke in court begging that Stephanie remain behind bars. Before Sherry's father passed away, he made sure to record a video message of himself to be played any time that Stephanie came up for parole, and that video was also played. The earlier decision to approve Stephanie's appeal was put on hold pending another hearing. In October 2024, that third hearing took place, and once again, Sherry's family had to get up there and fight for Stephanie to remain behind bars. Thankfully, this time the parole board came to a decision, and it was decided that she would not be released. While Stephanie was denied parole, District Attorney Paul Nunez says that it's most likely that she will appeal it and will ask for another parole hearing every year. So Sherry's family is going to have to go through this emotional roller coaster every single year. And I hate that so much for them. But Sherry's sisters and their children have vowed to continue their fight to keep that evil woman behind bars for good. Stephanie Lazarus is now 64 years old and remains behind bars at the California Institution for Women in Corona. Her most recent parole hearing was in February of this year, 2025, and she was once again denied. Sherry's loved ones feel the hole her absence has left daily. They miss her so incredibly much, and it's just so tragic to think about what could have been for her. She was a newlywed just beginning her life with the love of her life. She and John never really got the opportunity to live that married life together. They didn't get to start a family of their own and grow old together. After Sherry's passing, John moved on with his life, but I am sure he is plagued with the questions of what if. I'm sure he thinks of Sherry often and wonders about what their lives would be like today. And I'm sure he feels guilt for bringing Stephanie into Sherry's life. My heart goes out to everyone who loved Sherry. She seemed like an incredible, incredible woman. Crimesters, that is all that I have for this week's episode. If you're not already a part of my private Facebook group, make sure you join it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. If you want to follow me on Instagram to see what I've got going on in life, you can find me at Crimeaholly. And if you would like more bite-sized true crime content, you can find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. I will see you all next time. Always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.